I'm Jason Bradford.
I'm Asher Miller.
And I'm Rob Dietz. Welcome to Crazy Town, where McDonald's newest menu item is the 4-pound hippo bacon burger with cheese.
This is producer Melody Travers. In this season of Crazy Town, Jason, Asher, and Rob are exploring the watershed moments in history that have led humanity into the cascading crises we face in the 21st century. Today's episode is about the consequences of unleashing plant and animal species on unsuspecting ecosystems. The watershed moment took place in 1910. At the time, the estimated carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere was 300 parts per million, and the global human population was 1.76 billion.
Hey, Jason, Asher, it's good to be here with you.
Liar. Lying.
I am not lying.
Starting on a bad note.
I love working with the two of you. Huh. If I add myself, guess how many that makes? That makes three.
Yeah.
There are
count.
Three of us.
Yeah, that's good.
We're kind of known as the three weirdo hosts of Crazy Town. You know, we've got our personality quirks,
I accept
right?
it. I accept it.
Can't help it, man.
Yeah.
You have to.
At this point in your life.
Given the quirkitude that you exhibit, you've got to accept it.
Thank you.
Well, this week's story, the watershed moment in history, it features three guys that make us look like as normal as can be.
I think that's right. I'm going to represent, though, one of them who I think is weird. And it is kind of a competition. So my guy is going to try to out-weird your guys. Okay, so I'm going to talk about Robert Broussard. He is...
You said Broussard.
Broussard, yeah. Get this. Guess how weird this guy has to be. He's a U.S. House of Representatives guy.
Oh.
I think the bar has been set right there.
That's a high bar.
Yeah. From Louisiana, okay, in 1910. You think they're wacko now. Just imagine how absolute nuts.
Can I just assume he's white?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But he was also, you know, one of these like kind of talker guys, flesh pressures. How do you say it? Flesh pressers types.
Press the flesh, I think is what you're trying to say.
Yeah. This is the great part of the story for me, is that he is approached by a botanist. Okay. I love botanists.
Yeah. You are a botanist.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
These are generally brilliant, wise people. And the botanists, there's a problem. In recent history, like within the last 10 or 20 years, water hyacinth.
You can't speak today,
now,
my friend.
Water hyacinth had been introduced from South America to the southern U.S. and got into the swamps and canals in Louisiana. And it's still there today, and it's a beautiful plant, but it clogs things up. It grows so fast. And so the botanists couldn't figure out how to control it, but he had a great idea. Introduce hippos. Bring hippos to Louisiana. And this is so batshit crazy because hippos eat grass. They don't even fucking eat water plants. But anyway, for some reason, this botanist hadn't checked.
Well, we just took botanists down a couple of
pegs. I know. I'm upset.
So
this
scale.
Is the problem. It's like the botanist didn't do a great
job.
Well,
maybe botanists have learned a thing or two in the last century.
Yeah, he was kind of a narrow botanist.
Still thinking outside the box with the hippo thing. Well, so, okay, how about you, Asher? What is your guy?
Totally. I got this. I'm going to do laps around you, buddy.
Oh,
my
shit.
Guy. Okay. Frederick Russell Burnham.
Yeah.
He was this frontiers guy, you know, in the kind of the waning days of the frontier tracker. He was a warrior. There's some speculation that he was the inspiration for Indiana Jones.
Oh,
so just imagine this dude who,
I've just lost.
What could this guy do with a bullwhip?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. Now he loved to like put himself in these really horrible conditions and like test himself. So he was reported that he could go for like 2.5 days or so without sleeping, and he could smell water from afar, which doesn't make any sense to me. How do you smell water from afar?
That's great.
Yeah. Okay.
A frontiersman in the traditional American sense.
No, but so this guy, you know, he was like almost like a Teddy Roosevelt kind of character, because he signed himself up, I guess, to like be in the Boer War. You know, he was fighting for the South African side, went to Africa. He was famous because he like. hid out for 2 days in an aardvark hole, like watching the enemy, scouting them, and he would float down the river disguised as a dead cow, you know, to like check out what the enemy was doing.
The old dead cow ruse.
Yeah.
And he could smell nothing but water, so he was able to deal with it.
Yeah, apparently. When he was in the water, it was
the
it was
only
really
thing
strong.
He could smell was water. But he would also like to drink like and eat all kinds of crazy shit. He would make a cocktail out of 3 parts milk, 1 part fresh blood from a living ox, and drink that down. He would like take uncooked corn in his mouth and he would just chew on it until his jaw was like sore and he couldn't chew anymore. So yeah, I think my buddy Freddy's got you beat.
Probably.
Okay, well, thanks for that amateur hour, both of you guys, because I got Fritz Duquesne here.
Okay.
Now, Fritzy, he's got a special place in the Weirdo Hall of Fame, okay? So this guy also fought in the Boer War. I think you misspoke. Cool. Your guy was on the British side. My guy is on the South African side. He hates British people, just utterly hates them. amazing that these two guys both fought in this Boer War.
But on opposite sides.
But here's some fun stuff that old Duquesne got up to in his life. At one point, he decided he was going to make a movie. This is in 1914. He decides to do a travelogue on the Amazon River, but
that
never
would be
makes
really
it.
Really hard with that technology.
He never makes. Yeah. I think he was just collecting money to make it.
Oh, nice! Yeah.
And then World War I kicked off, and he was gone. So that was one of his little adventures. But that's nothing. Later, he gets into insurance fraud, and
you can see how one leads to the other.
Yeah, of course. Yes, well, yes. He gets caught and. He's on trial, and towards the end of the trial, he's giving testimony, and he falls down and claims that he's now paralyzed from the waist down.
Like a sudden immaculate paralysis?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so they rule that he's got some kind of mental problem, and they lock him up in Bellevue Hospital.
Oh,
where
nice.
He, insanity he fakes paralysis for 7 months.
What?
And then along the way, he gets a hacksaw, cuts through the window, and escapes.
Brilliant.
Damn.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now
gives
years,
me some ideas.
Years later,
yeah.
He's caught again as the alleged leader of a 33-person Nazi spy ring.
Sounds like a good guy.
Yeah.
I'm liking
this guy. Goes to Leavenworth for 20 years, and then finally he gets out of there and dies a couple years later. But I think this guy is the head weirdo of these three.
Yeah, so weirdo might not be the word I would use for him.
So how do they come together?
Okay, so they come together. You talked about the botanist guy's idea for bringing hippos in. All three of these guys, Congressman, Indiana Jones, and paralysis-faking Nazi, were all in on the hippo bill. These are the guys that were expert witnesses and going in front of Congress on that watershed date to propose that we introduce hippos into the Louisiana Bayou.
To deal with water hyacinth, even though they won't even eat that.
Well, that was one of the main points, but there was a whole nother angle on this as well.
Yes.
Let's just call it the meat angle.
Oh.
So the idea was we can solve all kinds of food shortage problems if we bring in hippos for meat.
So we almost had a McHippo industry, basically, in the U.S., like in a parallel multi-universe scenario.
Yeah, like
this bill passes instead of fails, and it's now the golden arches, and those refer to the butts of the hippo, basically. Yeah, those are rumps.
Yeah. Imagine the size of a ham coming off of
the kitchen. Whatever. Yeah, it'd be like straight from the Flintstones. Yeah.
Arby's would have been just fantastic in this scenario.
You know when you go to like a state fair and you get one of those big turkey legs?
Yeah.
Imagine you had a hippo leg.
Oh, my God.
Like you need like 7 people to carry that.
I don't think that drive up. You remember the early days of like fast food restaurants? They have like the waitresses on roller skates. It's like skating over to deliver your meal, and they put it like on your door.
Yeah,
you couldn't really do that with a hippo. Like,
no, I don't think so.
I've actually swam in like Louisiana. I've gotten on like on a P-row, and I've paddled through swamps and like jumped into the canals and stuff. And there's been water hyacinth around, and you know you've got some alligators you got to worry about a little bit, but hippos would be so terrifying. These are one of the most dangerous wild animals to humans that exist right
they
now.
They kill more people in Africa than any other animal.
Any
right?
other animal. So it's just absurd. So sure, we're gonna
have. But they taste real good.
Exactly. We're gonna have the wonderful hippo meat in this multi-universe.
Yeah, we'll domesticate them. They'll be all cuddly. We could pet them. Yeah, we could ride them.
Thousands of people will be dying every year from hippo injuries.
Well, I'm a fan of the Tooth and Claw podcast, which it's actually by a conservation or a wildlife biologist. And they actually talk about animal-human conflicts and describe the behaviors. And they did an episode on hippos, and it's terrifying. They were like, yeah, in a crocodile attack, like 70% of people survive. In a hippo attack, -12% of people survive. And they're like talking about this guy who actually survived, but you could see his lung afterwards. Like just these huge teeth just go right through you. Yeah. That'd be a scary thing to have all hanging around New Orleans.
Well, there was that educational game that they marketed when we were kids.
Hungry hippos.
Yeah, that was all to warn people about the dangers of hippos.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, hippos are becoming a little bit of a theme. You may recall my pygmy hippo story from our episode on domination of animals.
Because we love hippos.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So this watershed moment, again, it's these guys getting together to say, hey, let's bring hippos in. Apparently, Teddy Roosevelt was interested. Mainstream press was all excited. Like, this was almost a thing. We would have been eating chocolate-covered hippo eyeballs for dessert. It would have been.
God, I wish that all had transpired. It would have been so great. Maybe we should talk a little bit about why we're picking that as this watershed moment. We're talking here about the introduction of species, right? But before we get into maybe why we picked this specific one, I think it's worth talking about, maybe just making clear the distinction between introducing a species versus like the broader category of invasive species, right?
Yeah.
Because there are all kinds of invasive species. They can happen on a more quote-unquote natural, from more natural dynamics, right?
Yeah, like under their own power, a bird might fly to a landscape that it didn't inhabit before.
Right. Or it rides along in the hull of a cargo ship and just happens to sort of walk off or whatever. That's different than what these guys are trying to do.
Right. So the idea of introducing, and the other thing I should say is that in terms of thinking about this from the historical standpoint is we've actually, humans have introduced species for many, many millennia. You look at our domesticated crops, and so we've taken those and as we've migrated, we've brought those with us and planted them, whatever. So that is a form, of introducing new species.
Yeah, and I think what's going on now, the way that we sort of think about this and why we pick this moment, is you've gone from this, we are accidentally, the wider hyacinth is here and it's going crazy. And now we're saying, okay, let's go further. Let's no longer just sort of accept this passive movement of things. Let's figure out a way to bring something from the other part of the world, let it loose on our landscape, and reap the benefits.
Yeah.
As if we can control that. I kind of see this as like, this is full-blown rabid mania in action, like this idea that we can control something like this.
Well, the fact that this was a bill in the House of Congress.
Yes, it's institutionalized.
Yeah, you're doing it at the highest level, top-down approach to saying, we're going to make this policy, we're going to make this law,
right,
to do this.
Yeah,
I think we also picked it because freaking hippos in the bayou. Like, what? Yeah. What? What is happening here?
But think about, this is early 20th century. The country has gone through this incredible phase of growth, right? It has, the railroad systems have gotten in, cities have just boomed all over the nation, and industrialization is rampant now, right? It's just crazy going. All these consumer products are coming out. I think people were just feeling high on themselves. And when people are high and manic like this, they just do crazy things.
Yeah. Well, also the infrastructure set up. Now you've got all these trade networks. It's easier for for people to move all these different species around.
Yeah, I mean, if we're thinking about this as a food source, right? What did you have? We had the rail system in the United States that could support that. We have built a lot of this infrastructure, you know, industrial infrastructure to support something like this at a large scale.
The packing houses in Chicago could have made hippo sausage.
Oh, man.
You got a market right there.
Yeah, for sure.
Each sausage is 47 pounds. Yeah. This would have been a huge boon to the appliance industry.
You'd
have to have a refrigerator that's the size of a garage. You would need a
houses
oven.
Would have to be a lot bigger. That's true. Would have completely transformed the entire modern world, for sure. Yeah, you know, think of this a little bit as like what you said is this period that we've entered into, maybe around the point of this bill being introduced, where things are accelerating and growing at such a faster and more global clip, right? Mm-hmm. And in ecology, there's this concept, or the sustainability studies concept of the great acceleration. I think that was coined by Will Steffen. And looking at, basically, you know, we've talked about exponential growth curves and that dynamics of exponential growth and lots of things that sort of track that. I think one of the graphs that they charted, Will Steffen's project, was looking at the number of McDonald's, for example. And you see this hockey stick graph.
Yeah.
And you see sort of this dynamic happening with the introduction of species, right? So if you take the Hawaiian Islands, for example, Polynesians came there millennia ago, more than that, and they brought species with them. But the rate of change, I mean, prior to human arrival, there was something like maybe one new species was introduced every 50,000 years on those islands. Right?
Yeah, by natural. They're a long ways out there. Yeah.
That's the species getting there somehow
on its own.
Exactly. Then after the arrival of the Polynesians, which was not a couple thousand years ago, maybe 1,500 years.
Yeah, I think it's 4th century is the estimate.
They estimate that it jumped from like one species every 50,000 years to three or four new species every 100 years.
Yeah, in canoes or whatever.
So that's, talk about exponential growth, dramatic growth there. And then in modern times, there's something like 20 new species colonizing the islands each and every year.
It's every other time a plane touches down.
Right. And in fact, they're trying to do a lot of things to stop the introduction of species now. It's not being done intentionally now. It's just so many people coming in, they're... You know, there's all these things about people having shit on their shoes, and all of a sudden, you know, seeds.
I usually have a pygmy hippo with me wherever I go. It's one of your assistants.
Yeah,
what's
hippos,
it called? The emotional support animal.
Emotional support. How many seats do you have to book?
Well, it's a pygmy hippo.
Okay,
so
but still, you need a whole row at least, right?
So it sounds. I mean, let's back up a bit because it sounds crazy today, but if you go back to the 1800s, early 20th century. There were these societies. Like I used to be part of an academic society, you know, and I was a botanist, like the American Journal of Systematic Botanists or whatever. And you get their magazine, you get
wild
their journal.
Parties.
Yeah, wild parties. We have these conferences every year, and we just talk about plants and just go nuts, right? So
they probably did come in and like brag about who could grow the best marijuana or.
Those are the after hours parties.
It was not that interesting, unfortunately. But anyhow. There was a society for the acclimatization of animals, birds, fishes, insects, and vegetables. So these are people basically like, let's do it. Let's like bring everything we can here and get them acclimatized. So they were just really wanting to spread exotic species around the world. And sort of the poster child is the European starling, right?
Yeah, at least here in North America.
Yeah, here in North America. Gosh, it was brought in, I guess, because some guy was fond of Shakespeare is the lore. And so it's nuts. They were brought in for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, like his legitimate reason, right?
Yeah, his issue was he wanted any bird that was mentioned by Shakespeare, he thought should be populating our landscape. So
yeah.
He might be in there with our three weirdos
Well, you don't understand, Shakespeare's originally from North America, right?
Yeah.
He was writing about his childhood.
Yeah, what's the guy's name? Eugene Schifflin? Something like that?
Eugene Schifflin. I think he's like the Ringo Starr. He joins the band of our three other weirdos, and he's right in there with them. Because the stats on the starlings are freaking incredible.
Yeah,
he started with like I think he released 60 birds one year, and the next year he released another 40.
Yeah.
And then within 50 years, you had starlings in every state, and the population grew from 100 birds to more than 200 million in North
right.
America.
And it's like one of the most common birds you see now. So we think of them like, oh, look at those right. flocks that are moving, and they're wonderful, and there's these huge groups, and people stare at them like, and they are one of the most destructive birds in North America now.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's weird. It's like getting into agricultural crops and displacing a lot of native birds, and their population is gigantic.
I have to say, I do like watching, what they call those murmurations, where
yeah.
the flocks move and they make these crazy patterns.
Oh, yeah, it's stunning. I guess we lost the passenger pigeon, we got the starling.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm sure Shakespeare would be very proud. Lasting legacy.
So let's talk for a minute about why people do that. Like, why would somebody have been in the acclimatization society? Why this is happening? And there's this guy, John Long, who wrote a really good book on introduced mammals of the world. And he lists these reasons why we have people trying to introduce species all over the world. The first one is just for aesthetic reasons. That's like the starling, you know, like, oh, I like Shakespeare. I want the things he talked about around. A second reason would be like for commercial enterprises. And you could think of that like they introduced mink in Russia so that you could capture them and get fur coats off of it. There's the idea of controlling pests. Mm-hmm. Like you introduce kind of like what they were hoping to do with the hippo.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other examples where they actually did it.
Right. Cane toads.
Yeah. Mongoose were released so they could eat rabbits in New Zealand and just like wrecked the bird population there. And then there's accidents, escapes, and pet keeping. So we got to bring this back full circle to the hippos. You know, Pablo Escobar.
Yes, wonderful. One of my favorite drug kingpins.
Yeah, I don't know how many drug kingpins you can name.
Well, he was in the 80s, so it's like, you know, I grew up with the guy.
Well, so he had, like any good despot, he had a menagerie of animals on his private island or wherever it was. I guess it wasn't an island.
He just couldn't go spend his money anywhere, right? So he had to bring his money to him.
Right.
So he had imported 4 hippos from a zoo and added it to his private collection of exotic animals. Cher, when he got killed in 93, what happened?
Well, so what he had them in his pond, right, on his ranch. And some of... You know, he had a lot of animals, right? Most of them went to zoos, but the hippos were just left there.
Well, yeah, what are you going to... You're going to go in and leash
hippo,
up the
hippo
and walk
hippo,
it away?
Hippo.
Everyone's like...
You need a really big leash.
I can imagine, like, they had the kind of, like, sting operation to get Escobar. And then they're like, okay, we got to get these llamas out of here. Biff, you get the hippos out.
And he just, how do I have to do it?
He just leaves, like, right?
Where'd Biff go?
Yeah.
So just a dozen years later or so, I think there were 16 hippos, right? So this is what animals
do. It's spontaneous generation, right?
That's what it was. You just add some drops of water on top of them.
The birds, the bees, and the hippos.
Yeah. So,
that's not so bad. 16. That's only, you know, 16 hippo hams and you're done.
But they're spreading, right? So they're spotting hippos now on the Magdalena River, and there are 3 individuals seen on the Kokorna River. The population in the basin there is estimated to be growing something like 7 or 8% a year, which means, I don't know, by 2050 they could have as many as like 800.
That's a 10-year doubling time in population.
Right.
Well, what's exciting to me is that it didn't happen in North America, but there's a chance it's going to happen in Colombia.
Right.
Oh, so that's kind of cool.
Well, like, climate changes, maybe eventually they'll be moving.
Yeah,
I mean, if they can swim across the Panama Canal, I don't see why they couldn't.
Well, they don't even have to swim when you get one of those cargo ships stuck in there. It just walks
across. Yeah.
So
like
anyway, we could see them in the Rio Grande in 80 years or something.
Yeah. That's amazing. So
there won't be a Rio Grande. It'll be... Trout, sorry.
Yeah.
There's one other reason why people try to introduce these species, especially mammals, and that's for food, hunting, and sport, which we talked about food some with the hippo. But I got to tell you guys a quick little story. I used to live in New Mexico, and I had this good friend of mine, Patrick. Maybe you're listening out there, Patrick. Patrick's a conservationist, a hunter. He and I were both working at the Fish and Wildlife Service at the time, and he asked me if I wanted to go hunting with him. And I'd never been hunting. I'm like, yeah, I'll give that a try. So, you know, we had all the right permits and stuff, and he takes me out hunting. We're going for elk, never shot anything, but had a great time just kind of stalking around the mountains and trying to track him. And we finished with our 2-3 day hunt. We load up the truck. We're headed home to Albuquerque, coming down out of the mountains. And he tells me, he's like, hey, Rob, I got to make a quick stop along the way. And I'm like, oh, okay. He says, I actually killed something a couple weeks ago, and I sent it to the taxidermist. And Patrick's not the kind of guy that has, like, you know, squirrel heads on his wall or anything like that. But he's like, I feel kind of like a dummy, but I just felt like I had to get this thing stuffed. And I'm like, okay, well, what is it? And he said, oh, it's an oryx. I'm like, what the hell is that? And he said, oh, it's this African antelope that they released down around White Sands National Monument, which is now a national park. And yeah, it's this crazy looking, awesome animal. It's got like black face paint, it kind of looks like, on a white background. Sort of like a member of the rock band Kiss. And has these really cool, super long horns coming off. And yeah, you got to have a pretty high ceiling if you're going to mount one of these suckers.
But is it like an antelope, but bred with Kiss?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah. We don't want to question what Gene Simmons does in his off hours, but yeah, no, I was just amazed that, so this species, they brought it in specifically as a species to hunt and to have around as food. And I actually later even tasted some because Patrick had the meat from that.
Did it taste like hippo?
Yeah, it was a lot like hippo.
Oh,
yeah. No, it was really good, but it just kind of blew me away that here's this African species that I had no idea was here. And I even, a year or so later, I was visiting one of the biologists at a national wildlife refuge down around southern New Mexico, and we came across a kill where a mountain lion had taken apart an oryx, so you could see the bones and the fur and all that. But they're around and now just part of the ecosystem.
They're not small.
No, it's a big animal.
Props to the mountain lion.
I know. It probably has like about a 50% chance of being impaled every time it attacks one of those.
So I think it's worth just, and we've touched on this a little bit, but it's worth talking about the fact that this is really a global phenomenon. You know, we're talking about context here in the United States, but this has been happening all over the world, including in places that have been colonized by Westerners, Europeans, you know, relatively recently. And I think Australia tends to be sort of the case for this, right? People talked a lot about the issues that they've had with the introduction of rabbits, you know, and when you bring species into like a new ecosystem, they can either die out
like rabbits.
Exactly. Or they could find a niche and just go like nuts. And it's interesting to just think about like all the different kinds of species that have been introduced just into Australia. You know, you got horses, cane toads, right? They brought those in actually because they were trying to deal with this cane beetle that was killing sugar cane that they were trying to grow there. So they brought the cane toad in, and that's grown sort of out of control. My favorite, I guess, is the camel, right? So if you ever want to stump anybody, you ask them, you know, what country has the largest population of camels in the world, right?
Yeah.
And how many feral camels would you guess, you know, were in Australia until just recently, last decade or so?
Like, if I'm being real, I would have thought, you know, if you said, where are camels in Australia, I'd say the zoo.
Right.
Right.
There were a million feral camels roaming around Australia.
Wow.
Until, you know, recently they've been doing this, and they've done this with all of these species, trying to figure out ways of controlling the population. So they've done a lot of things to try to reduce the population. They're down to something like 300,000 now, right?
Yeah.
Which is inconceivable.
Oh, maybe we should think about introducing hippos to handle the camel population.
I'm sure the hippos would do great in central Australia.
Are you sure, Jason, they don't eat camels and grass?
Let's just try it.
I know. Why not?
You gotta try things.
Oh, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Yeah.
You miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Well,
come on, give me some more cliches.
Well, here, I just want to like geek out a second. So what we're dealing with, the concept is often called ecological release, where you have basically something that's moved out of where it evolved. And when things evolve in a particular region, there's all this coevolution with parasites and viruses and other things that might tamp down its ability to grow. And so ecological release is the sense that, oh my gosh, I'm in a climate that is similar to where I evolved, but there's no more diseases that will like make me sick. And so that's often why these things just take off and they can outcompete the natives. It's just nothing is keeping them in check.
Yeah.
Well, and of course, nowadays we want to steward a lot of them, right? In terms of contribution.
A lot of what? Camels?
Well, a lot of exotic species. Okay. Not, maybe the camels, but but like I was looking at some of the economic stats and it's something like 85% of industrial forestry plantations are established with species from just three genuses.
Yeah.
Or genera, I guess, if you want to speak correctly.
I'm a genius.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, pines, teaks, and eucalyptus.
Yeah, yeah. And then I was looking at the nation of New Zealand, where more than 95% of its export earnings are from introduced species, probably cows,
sheep and cattle. Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things that is a consequence of all this that's worth mentioning is just the lack of diversity. And what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the risks associated with that. We have that with bananas, right?
Yeah. So for agriculture, it's true. Yeah. Like almost all agricultural species you could think of as these introduced species, right? And so, boy, concentration of the calorie foods we grow. It's wheat, it's maize or corn, what we call maize or corn, rice, potatoes, barley, cassava, soybean, sugarcane, oats. Those dominate, those nine crops are 70% of the world's food. And each is cultivated way beyond its natural range.
Oh, so, yeah. Do you ever like go on Google Earth or Google Maps in the Midwest and just look at the dominance that soybeans and corn have over that landscape?
Yeah, it's fat. I grow vegetables where I am. Most of what I grow is vegetables. There are other things too. And so it's fascinating to me to think about. I try to make what I grow really diverse because it's interesting. So this diversity is interesting. We've taken things from around the world and combined them. And so in a sense, we have more diverse diets maybe in some ways than we would have otherwise. So like just from Africa this last year, I grew cowpeas, sorghum, okra, roselle, and watermelon. And of course, I grew stuff from the Americas, stuff from Europe and Asia.
And in the creek alongside the
farm. So you're introducing, you're the bad guy here. You're introducing all kinds of species.
Well, he put a couple hippos in the creek out here too.
Yeah, don't tell the watershed council. Jesus.
Well, I'm not going swimming in the creek anymore. It's a little scary.
Yeah. But yeah, so that we've spread our crops all over the place.
Can we just name the thing that probably a lot of our listeners are like, excuse me. There's an invasive species you haven't talked about, and that is us humans. I mean, I think it was John Long, the guy who wrote the book that you referenced, Rob, earlier. He said, no mammal species has extended its range over such a large area of the world as humans, and neither has any other species had such an impact on changing habitat quality, quantity, and diversity for so many other species,
which is
obviously true.
Yep, right on.
I mean, in modern history, of course, there was, you know, the species that first were able to make oxygen, and that transformed the world. But yeah, I think, you know, if you're talking the last tens of millions of years.
But
yeah.
Look at our ability to go into all kinds of ecosystems, different climates, and we're amazingly capable.
Now we're talking about like ocean, deep ocean mining.
We're talking about going into fucking space.
I know,
right?
We're freaking meddlers, though. I mean, I remember as a little kid, we would go fish in this lake, and we would catch a little bluegill or a crappie, and then we would carry it away from the lake and stick it in another body of water. I have no idea why we would do that. Like zero idea. What were we doing? Why were we doing that?
Because you're curious, right?
Yeah. We just always think that we can make things better somehow. It's this sort of hubris.
Yeah.
But you know, it ends up biting us in the hippo butt, I think, a lot of the time, right? These invasions have all these economic costs. Of course, there's ecological ravaging ecological, but we want to put dollar signs on them. So it's easier to get stats on the dollar.
It's all about the money.
It's all about the money. So just for like the starling example again, like I mentioned that, geez, they ravage crops because there's these huge flocks and they come in and they can just wipe out a crop. So there was a review by George Lintz et al. And it estimated that starlings cause $800 million in agricultural damage annually in North America. They have They're also, of course, you know, they run into airplanes and stuff, so it's rough.
$800 million.
Yeah, I mean, there's massive programs in every part of the world, you know, that calculate like the cost that zebra mussels have or whatever, clogging up water, or how much, you know, kudzu costs. Just everywhere you can go, there's some terrible thing that is wreaking some sort of havoc that we now put monetary damage on.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
And we should just distinguish here. We're just talking about species that we've introduced for other reasons. We're not talking about our like domesticated protein animals or whatever, right? Which do unbelievable damage.
Correct.
Wow. Yep.
These are the unwanted. These are the things we consider pests. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I want to, even though it is all about the money, I want to spend a couple seconds talking about the environmental damage. And, you know, these animal invaders, they cause direct extinctions, right? By preying upon, you know, native species. Like, that's what's, it's really sad in New Zealand what's happened. They had just this awesome bird diversity, things like ground parrots, kakapo, they're just getting hammered by rats and mongoose eating the eggs before they can even hatch.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you also have competition for grazing resources, and then some of these species really alter habitat. Like, you think about when a plant invades an ecosystem, the water hyacinth is a good example. It takes that over, and sometimes they can change the fire regime, the nutrient regime, the hydrology, energy budgets, all that.
There's all this trickle down, like the cascading effects. My wife and I one time climbed to the highest peak in Tahiti, you know, one of these Polynesian islands, and we're camping out there. And at night, all these rats came out. And it was just like, she couldn't sleep. She couldn't sleep. She's like, and thanks, Polynesians. Right. And so all these birds then go extinct all over. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we often forget about the diseases that come along. Like, chestnut blight is the one that always kind of strikes at my heart. Wiping out this majestic tree all over North America.
Yeah.
And there's that hippo rash. You know, that, it only affects left-handed people for some reason.
Yeah. But let's bring it back into the crazy town sort of, you know, connection here. These nutty people, the three guys we talked about, they all had the best of intentions. Maybe not the guy that was in Leavenworth.
I don't know if the Nazi paralysis guy had great intentions.
Okay. But, you know, my guy, my Louisiana politician, he thought he was introducing a bill that was going to help his constituents eat more hippo meat and take care of a terrible problem in the shipping industry. This is the thing. It's like, we do batshit crazy stuff with good intentions because we're just like idiotic and manic and think we have so much control and power, but then we let the freaking genie out of the bottle and go, oh crap. But how many times do we look back and say, how could we have done that? But we never ask today, like, what the hell are we doing? You know?
Yeah, it's almost like we feel like we've solved ourselves when we're kind of still on it. It's not that we have an acclimatization society anymore, but we still have massive shipping of exotic species and global trade. It's
huge business.
Introductions happen all the time. I mean, the pythons in southern Florida are now probably everywhere in Florida, but that was not an acclimatization society thing in 1898. That's pretty recent.
Yeah.
But people were thinking about this and aware of it to some degree, even way back when, around the time of this hippo bill. Let me read you a quote.
Okay.
We ourselves are the only reason. This is from about over 100 years ago, right?
Okay.
We ourselves are the only reason why none of this precious game, you're talking about game in the wild,
bison
in the West,
like,
can ever live in our wild plains. So intent are we on destruction that we've become the wonder of the world. We have dynamited our fish, killed all our buffalo, carried off even his bones in train loads, and came back with herds of cattle, tramped out and ate all of the finest natural grass ever known. I've seen forest fires 40 miles wide burning in the Sierras to make early grass for herds of sheep. If it were known that a herd of eland were on the Rio Grande, 1,000 guns would be after them and their hides sold to the nearest tannery.
What is that, John Muir, Aldo Leopold?
That's my buddy Burnham.
Oh!
Which is what's so crazy about this. On the one hand, he sees that.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, he's like, well, solution, of course.
Yeah. Bring in the hippos.
Let's introduce hippos. We can hunt those guys. Right?
Yeah. So there's like awareness and then naked opportunity.
Doesn't it remind you, we talked about Jeff Bezos, remember?
I
get so riled up every time I talk about this, you know, this presentation that Bezos gave, you know, when he was launching his space penis company.
Blue Origin or whatever.
You know, he's just talking about all these issues that we're facing, stuff that would have come out of the mouth of anyone at PCI, you know, about energy constraints and limits of efficiency and all this stuff and exponential growth. And he's like, yeah, we only have two choices, you know? Oh, the path we're on, we're just going to have to ration. It's like,
I know.
Well, no, fuck that. We're going to space.
I know. He even uses the R word. Yeah. I'm just like, my jaw dropped.
Right. So but it's then, the same. It's the same thing. This is this what you're talking about. It's this hubris.
I hope we don't accidentally reinvigorate the hippos in the bayou idea, and Bezos makes that part of his space penis platform.
I'm sure he has
hippos in space.
There'll probably be one of his like orbiting colonies. Right. Yeah. He probably is going to have a hippo one.
He's got to have some.
Yeah,
hippos.
He's got to recreate the African wetland.
They're heavy. To transport. That's the only downside.
That's a problem.
Maybe the pygmy ones.
Let's get the pygmy ones up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot going on, though, now where we are still trying to fix things. And some of the fixing is this techno-fix stuff. And some of the fixing is really ecologically minded. Like, nowadays, it's much harder to pass a bill to introduce hippos, right? So we do have ecological thinking going on in how we try to manage introductions of species.
Yeah. Speaking of Crazy Town related to this stuff, I think we have to talk a little bit about how crazy making it is to be aware of the stuff that we're talking about here, right? Of the dangers, the risks of introducing species when we're in a situation now because of climate change. You know, my family has been very involved over the years in trying to plant native species. When we're living in California, especially because of the drought conditions, we only planted native species. We're in a situation now where, because the climate is changing so rapidly, that what once had been the right habitat for species is no longer the right habitat. And we were just dealing with that here. We have Douglas fir on our property, and there's a group of three of them that are diseased and have to be cut down.
Oh, yeah.
And they're sort of on the sort of this corner edge of our lot that actually gets a little bit of sun.
And so, they're huge.
Yeah. So we were talking about, well, what do we plant there instead, you know? And
eucalyptus.
We're talking to an arborist, right?
Bringing some koalas to munch on the leaves.
And he was saying, well, honestly, you should think about getting white oaks, you know, which are not indigenous. They're not. They're from, you know, California, essentially, right?
Well, there's an Oregon white oak behind you right now, but he must have been talking about something.
Yeah.
And
basically saying, look, the climate's changing. Yeah. You need to bring in species that are going to be able to withstand drier conditions.
Right.
You know, I think you should plant a coral reef there. I mean, they're hurting.
It makes a lot of sense to plant it in landlocked, a little residential neighborhood.
Yeah, think ecologically here.
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is I'm affiliated with other institutions, Institute for Applied Ecology, and they are trying to put ecosystems back together, okay, that are fragmented. Like taking an old wheat field. There's one actually a mile and a half from here. They've done an amazing job at Herbert Farm, for example, turning it into a restoration site with native prairie again. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating, though, is they're thinking about this in the context of climate change and saying to themselves, well, how do we do this and allow for the diversity of plant communities to change and shift what is necessary? So not only are ecologists dealing with trying to recreate, restore habitats that are lost, they're also they're struggling with how do you also put something back that will be able to respond to changing environmental conditions? And they're at least aware of the problem and debating it openly on what are the best strategies.
Wow, that sounds like somebody who's thinking about how to fix some of these problems, which is going to take us directly into our Do the Opposite segment.
Oh, okay. Let's go there.
Okay, Jason and Asher, I've got another awesome review to share from one of our listeners here in Crazy Town.
My bruised ego lives for this moment.
I need a little pick-me-up, too. Yes. Yeah, okay. It's like fan mail.
This one comes to us from Irritating 1000.
That sounds great.
Okay. Smart, sarcastic, funny, want to laugh and cry at the same time, have learned a lot, and even better, have been moved to get off my butt and get actively involved.
Nice. But to actively involved by irritating people? Is that the...
Well, you know, I don't know what kind
Everyone
of
Everyone plays their part.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe we need some irritants in the system out there. Yeah. Seriously, thank you for that very kind review. It really does make us feel good, and we hope it influences everyone else out there to go and rate and review us, and maybe we'll get to yours on the air.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
So, in terms of doing the opposite, we've had all these introduced species that, you know, like you said earlier, Jason, that we kind of let the genie out of the bottle. You can't just stuff it back in. So what is it that we are going to do? On the one hand, I would just echo something you were talking about earlier, Jason, that ecologically, we've gotten a little bit smarter. Not saying we're wise yet, but you can't just pass a hippo bill these days. You actually have programs, and I was involved in this with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Geological Survey, trying to target invasive species as a problem, and it's the exact opposite of an acclimatization society.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, we were just talking about that. This stuff exists. There are lots of resources for people in terms of thinking about planting, with the caveats that we just talked about in terms of climate changes. Planting native species and programs, even grassroots programs, are great ones around here that some of the environmental groups do. And I'm sure in everyone that's listening, most, you know, communities or a lot of them, ways for people to actually get involved, right?
Yeah.
And removing invasive species from a local habitat.
And nurseries nowadays, I can go to a local nursery and usually find a section that is native plants. And that was not true, like, you know, 15 years ago. It's very rare. So that's pretty cool. But, you know, we talked about how it was the globalization of trade and shipping stuff all over the world really was part of the acceleration that happened. And so one of the ways that we can also reduce the likelihood of new invasive species coming in is support local economic production, reduce the amount of stuff we just ship around all over the place. Mm-hmm. So that's,
of course, you have to convince everyone you know to do the same as well. You know, and then once we've relocalized, we're golden.
I just go back to the example of my little situation in California. When we moved into this house, we ripped out the lawn that was in the front. We planted, and I shouldn't say we, my wife.
Yes.
She doesn't listen to this, so I don't have to worry too much. But she's the one who did all this work, okay?
Yeah.
She hears your voice enough as
exactly.
it is.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, she really did it. I was just some labor on occasion. But, you know, planting native plants
and growing a garden, a food garden, too.
Yeah. It was really remarkable to see, without us ever really talking about it, proselytizing, any of that stuff, that one by one, neighbors on our block all started ripping out their lawns. And by the time we left the neighborhood, I would say 70% of them were no longer. And the drought helped, obviously, to motivate people to get rid of their grass. But it was the modeling of it that I think helped people kind of adopt those practices and imagine doing something differently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and Jason, you and I were up on Mount Tabor week or so ago.
Yeah, it's in Portland.
It's a cool extinct volcano in Portland that's been turned into a park. And we were both just noticing how, compared to a lot of sort of urban natural areas that we've been to, there weren't that many, what would you call outbreaks of invasives.
The Himalayan,
like the English
blackberry.
Ivy wasn't everywhere.
English ivy, right. It wasn't too bad. I was like, wow, this is actually looks like a forest.
And that's definitely due to volunteers going in and ripping that stuff out on a regular basis. I think it's coordinated pretty well there. So yeah, you can join those kinds of things and do that. But I think there's a bigger thing, and that's a change of attitude.
Yeah.
You know, it's that idea, instead of we dominate nature. We control, like we're going to put animals on the landscape like you would arrange the chess pieces on a chessboard. We can't be thinking like that. We have to think like we're part of this. These are things that we live with, not things that we control and dominate.
And the more we see that we live in systems that have their own dynamics, right? I mean, these invasive species should have taught us all that there's this cascading effect that can happen when you when you make one change in a system, you know, it can have this rippling effect. So the idea that we could sort of be like, oh, we'll just do this one little intervention, right, you know, and it won't have, we could sort of isolate that. It's very much a sort of manufacturing linear kind of thinking that might work from a industrial mindset. We're going to build this product and we're putting in this input. It's going to have that output, blah, blah, blah. We're talking about systems, living systems with these interactions that we can't necessarily understand, you know? So yeah, I think getting rid of that hubris, that pretense, you know, that we can control, even though even indigenous communities have practiced some measure of control over nature. We're not talking about completely divorcing ourselves from our relationship with nature, but it is a relationship.
Yeah. Right? And I think nowadays botanists, if they were advising Congress, they would know that hippos don't eat water hyacinth. I think nowadays we've advanced to that point, and that makes me happy because then I don't have to be upset by that botanist character.
Look, I don't care what hippos eat. All I know is I want to eat some hippo. So what do you say we go out, maybe down to
Pablo Escobar's,
down to Escobar's old place,
hot.
And we get us some hippo sushi going.
You go first, okay? And I'll just be standing behind a little.
All right, I'll get an eyeball for you. We want to give a special thanks to Ilana Zuber, our star researcher of the watershed moments through history. Without her work, there's no way we could have covered such sweeping topics this season.
Yeah, and we also want to thank our other outstanding volunteers. Anya Steyer provides original artwork for us, and Taylor Antal prepares the transcripts for each episode.
And a big, big thank you to our producer, Melanie Travers, who helps us bozos stay professional.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners. If you want to help others find their way to Crazy Town, please drop us a 5-star rating and hit that share button when you hear an episode you like.
Folks, we know that governments and underfunded nonprofits are just not coping with the invasive species crisis. I mean, just the other day, I was able to purchase 82 king cobras and release them into the fields near my home. But instead of continuing to contribute to the problem, why not become a citizen willing to fight for the sanctity of your homeland? Inspired by the classic 80s movie, Red Dawn, the Wolverine Corps is an association of militant freedom from invasive species fighters, and it is calling on you to join its ranks. How? Well, for only $19.95, you can get access to their extensive library of counterinsurgency techniques in the form of hundreds of trifold pamphlets and VHS tapes. Step-by-step guidance is provided to turn you into the badass weed puller, invasive toad squisher, and starling nest spotter you were meant to be. Wolverine Corps, don't just sit on your ass, be a badass.
Crazy Town, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Crazy Town.